Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. New Year's Day, 1818. Mary Shelley's tale of a modern-day Prometheus first graced London bookshelves. Frankenstein was dismissed by critics at first, Gothic literature, a genre not respected at the time, but audiences loved it. Translated and adapted almost immediately, readers were captivated. And now, 200 years later, science, medicine, and ethics have finally caught up with the deep questions raised within Frankenstein's now iconic pages. This hour, On Point, dissecting Mary Shelley's classic, as we mark its bicentennial. You can join us on air or online. How do you know Frankenstein? The book? The movies? The cereal box? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Jill Lepore, a professor of American history at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find a piece, a link to her piece, headlined The Strange and Twisted Life of Frankenstein, at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Jill Lepore, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So great to have you. I want to start us off with this iconic scene from the 1931 film adaptation of Frankenstein, where Dr. Henry Frankenstein, played by Colin Clive, discovers his experiment was successful.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. In the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God.
It's alive, it's alive, it's a classic line, right, Professor Lepore?
Not to be confused with the Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks version.
Yes, exactly. We've got more of that to come. Well, before we get to the content of the iconic novel Frankenstein, tell us a little bit about the author, Mary Shelley, because her story is worth a book on its own. Tell us who she was.
Yeah, so Mary Shelley, it's funny hearing even that clip, the way that the filmmakers reinterpret that scene as Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein being God, when really he's usurping the role of woman. And that, in many ways, was Shelley's chief concern, I think, arguably. Mary Shelley was quite a famous young woman for the sake of her name. Her full name was Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley. She was the daughter of the famous 18th century feminist Mary Wollstonecraft, who died just a few days after giving birth to her. Wollstonecraft, who'd written Vindication of the Rights of Women, a response to the work of Edmund Burke, a really important political philosopher, had married, while pregnant, William Godwin, an equally important 18th century political philosopher. And their daughter, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, later married the famous poet Percy Shelley. So Shelley was attached to all these quite famous people, yes, and in some ways rendered invisible by the fact that her name is really just an assemblage of their names.
Well, in fact, she published this book anonymously, right, in 1818, largely out of concern that she might lose custody of her kids.
It is a really scandalous book at the time that it is published, and it is quite a scandal for a young woman to publish such a scandalous book. She was very sensitive of that. Her husband, they were married by the time the book came out, but she had run away from her home with Percy Shelley at a time when he was married and his wife was pregnant. This was itself a scandal. Her life had become quite a famous scandal. He was trying to get custody of his children from his first wife. She was worried that they would lose custody of the children that they had if it was discovered that she was the author of this quite scandalous book.
So how the book came about. Mary Shelley and her husband spent a summer with Lord Byron and other literary titans. And this is how Frankenstein was born. Tell us how.
Yeah, it's somewhat mythical. Shelley herself tells this story, and it's true, but she also exaggerates the importance of this origin story, because one of the things she's trying to do is pretend that she's not really responsible for this scandalous tale, because it is so scandalous. But when she runs away with Shelley, she brings her stepsister with her, who also would like to be ruined by one of these romantic poetic geniuses. They summer with the famously dissipate Lord Byron, and bored one evening, they have a contest for who can write the scariest ghost story. The only one of these stories to endure is the nugget, the kernel of the story of Frankenstein as Shelley composes it.
I love what you write, that Frankenstein is four stories in one, an allegory, a fable, an epistolary novel, and an autobiography, a chaos of literary fertility. Explain what you mean by that, four stories
in
one.
Well, it's so funny. You know, people tend to really conflate the 1931 Boris Karloff film.
Yeah, yes.
And, you know, even sort of the Addams Family Munsters
right.
pop culture version of everything is Frankensteinian in our culture, and have often never read the novel. So one of my objectives here was to reacquaint people with the novel itself, which has quite an intricate structure. In fact, the story that we just heard that clip from, where the monster, who is himself unnamed, where the monster comes alive, is buried deep within the. We get there through unraveling these layers of a kind of Russian doll structure. You know, it begins with this explorer trying to reach the North Pole, who comes across this starving, crazed man running across the ice, and he tells him his story. And so there's the explorer. Then that's Frankenstein, who's not a doctor but is a medical student, who tells the story. And in the course of that story, he meets the monster, who tells his creator, his own story. So it's a story within a story within a story. And each of these stories has a different politics, has a really different politics at the time. That's one of the things that we have kind of forgotten, how controversial the novel was because of its political stance.
Here's a clip from the 1994 movie, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The creature played by Robert De Niro asks his creator, Dr. Victor Frankenstein, played by Kenneth Branagh, if he has a soul.
What of my soul? Do I have one? Or was that a part you left out? Who were these people of which I am comprised? Good people? Bad people?
Material is nothing more.
You're wrong.
Jill Lepore, professor of American history at Harvard. Tell us about some of the themes in Frankenstein, bringing someone back to life, confronting the fear of your own mortality and the like. What do you see in it?
Well, actually, one of the things I like about that Branagh film, which I otherwise think is quite terrible, is that the monster is eloquent there and reckoning with the meaning of his own existence. Why was I created? It's a retelling of the story of Genesis. That's why it's called the modern Prometheus. The Boris Karloff film makes the monster inarticulate. All he does is grunt. But in the novel, the monster is the most eloquent of characters. He teaches himself to speak and then to read and to write, and he reads political philosophy, and he comes to question the political order. And that's why the novel is revolutionary. And the way in which Americans at the time understood it, and the theme I think is really important for us to wrestle with a little bit, because it's often overshadowed by the, isn't this a metaphor about modern science, is that the story really is in many ways about slavery. Frederick Douglass famously said, slavery is the pet monster of the American people. People talked about the Frankenstein story, Americans talked about the Frankenstein story in the 19th century as being a metaphor for slavery, that people had created this monster. This person who was not allowed to enter society as on equal terms, as a citizen, as fully human, and that this haunted the American political imagination, destroyed our politics all the way, you know, through the Civil War, and casts a shadow today. So I think that's actually a really important theme in the novel that Shelley was quite aware of. She and her husband were very averse to slavery. They didn't eat sugar because it was produced by forced labor on the slave islands in the British colonies. So it's a really quite important and I think often unrecognized theme of the novel.
You mentioned in the beginning, and it caught my ear, and you write about it in your piece, this notion of the stripping out of everything female from this story, the stripping out of the sex and the birth in Frankenstein. Tell me about that loss of femaleness within this story.
Yeah, I mean, Shelley was pregnant at the age of 16. She was pregnant as a very young woman out of wedlock. She bore a child. And she tells a story in her very moving diary of nursing the baby. She's sort of nursing, reading. Any woman who's breastfed, who's interested in words and books and ideas, nursing, reading while nursing. She puts the baby to bed one day, and she wakes up in the middle of the night, her breasts are full, she wants to nurse, but the baby seems to be asleep, she doesn't want to wake it, and in the morning the baby is dead. And for nights she dreams that she's brought the baby back to life, maybe if she just had taken the baby in the middle of the night, rubbed it by the fire, she would have been able to bring the baby back to life. So much of the novel really is about that as well, about loss and about the suffering of women in childbirth and in the loss of children and in the suffering of children and the loss of their mothers. Mm. Sherry, of course, lost her own mother just a few days after she was born. And so much of that suffering is so moving that I love that people read this novel again and again and again, because a novel that we still read is a novel that still has something to say to us. And it does tell us a lot about science and about the recklessness and heedlessness of science. It's a cautionary tale. But I think that really we need to hold on to what Shelley was trying to tell us about. Isn't the purpose of scientific progress to relieve suffering? Mm. And this is a story about scientists producing suffering.
I want to get Cody in here from Savannah, Georgia. Cody, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to talk more about the feminist themes in Mary Shelley's work. Our family traces our history back to Mary and Percy Bysshe Shelley, and I really love to hear the speaker talk a little bit more about those feminist themes.
Cody, thank you. We have about 30 seconds left, and I know, Professor, you have to go to teach a class. What would you say to Cody about the feminist themes in Frankenstein?
Yeah, I mean, the novel sadly was set aside as a feminist parable for many generations. It's not until 1951 when Muriel Spark writes a biography of Shelley, when she insists on a feminist reading of the novel, which then is taken up in the 1970s. And I talk about all this in my piece because it's actually such a powerful way to think about Shelley as vindicating the memory of her mother who had been much discredited. But her mother's feminist political philosophy finds a place in the telling of the story. So I very much celebrate that, and it really has to do with a critique of the power of men and men's attempt to usurp the creative power of women.
Mm. Cody, thanks for the call. And Professor Jill Lepore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor of History, American History at Harvard University. She wrote about Mary Shelley and Frankenstein in this week's issue of The New Yorker. Professor, thanks again. I'm Jane Clayson. We'll get to your calls and much more after this break. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about Frankenstein this hour, its story, its themes, and the questions it raises. 2018 marks the 200th anniversary of its publication. You can join the conversation, listeners. How did this story become so iconic? Do you find it even more timely today? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here is Dr. Henry Frankenstein, played by Colin Clive in the 1931 film, describing his ambition and what he would say to his critics.
Have you never wanted to do anything that was dangerous? Where should we be if nobody tried to find out what lies beyond? You never wanted to look beyond the clouds and the stars, or to know what causes the trees to bud, and what changes a darkness into light? But if you talk like that, people call you crazy. Well, if I could discover just one of these things, what eternity is, for example, I wouldn't care if they did think I was crazy.
And fast forward to 1974, here's the creation scene from the Mel Brooks parody, Young Frankenstein, where Dr. Frederick Frankenstein, played by Gene Wilder, outlines his motivation for animating the creature.
From that fateful day when stinking bits of slime first crawled from the sea and shouted to the cold stars, I am man. Our greatest dread has always been the knowledge of our own mortality. But tonight, we shall hurl the gauntlet of science into the frightful face of death itself. Tonight, we shall ascend into the heavens. We shall mock the earthquake. We shall command the thunders and penetrate into the very womb of impervious nature herself.
Ah, classics. Joining me now from Tempe, Arizona, is Ed Finn, co-director of Arizona State University's Frankenstein Bicentennial Project and the co-editor of the 2017 edition of Frankenstein, annotated for scientists, engineers, and creators of all kinds. He's also a professor and the director of the Center for Science and Imagination at ASU. Ed Finn, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And with me from Atlanta, Georgia, is Sidney Perkowitz, Professor Emeritus of Physics at Emory University and the co-editor of the 2018 collection of essays titled Frankenstein, How a Monster Became an Icon. Sidney Perkowitz, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. A pleasure to be here.
Ed Finn, where does Frankenstein belong in the literary canon, to your mind?
Well, there are a lot of ways to answer that, but maybe the best would be to say it's one of the most widely read books out there. There's a college syllabus survey project online that suggests that this is the most widely read novel in the United States for college students. And you can tell how impactful it is because everybody borrows and steals from Frankenstein. It's countlessly retold and reimagined and reworked into new novels, plays, movies. Its ubiquity, I think, tells us how important it is to us.
Sidney Perkowitz, how should we be looking at Frankenstein today, 200 years after its publication?
We should look at it as one of the richer novels ever made. Along with quantity, it has its richness. And many of its angles apply more today than they ever did. I'm talking about the scientific angle, the possibility of modifying and creating life. But as you heard from our previous speaker, it also has angles that have to do with how humans relate to each other, how men relate to women, and all the rest of it. I think we could look at it in a dozen different ways, the scientific one being one of the leading ones for our present time.
Ed Finn, you described Frankenstein as having, quote, an early viral narrative because it was adapted, translated, circulated in so many different ways, with each new version bringing a different take, if you will. Talk about that a little bit. The original creature was not the shambling, grunting, green-faced creature played in the movies, right?
That's right. And as people began to borrow it, so it was published in a relatively small print run and when it was first published in 1818. Mary Shelley never made very much money from Frankenstein. But almost immediately it was a book, because it was so scandalous, as Jill Lepore was saying earlier, people were reading it and talking about it, and very quickly they began to adapt it for the stage. I think the first stage production was in the early 1820s, and there were many of them that came after that. It was translated, and as people borrowed it and ripped it off, and in those days intellectual property was a very different beast, and so people could freely take things and translate them to another medium. They put their own spin on it, dealing with the creature as a sort of a problem, right? How do you deal with this thing? You make it look alien. Do you make it? Should it be able to speak or not? People dealt with that in different ways. There was one wonderful adaptation where the creature was actually made out of sort of contemporary quack medicine products, so Pars life pills and all these things you would see in 19th century magazines for sale to help you with your digestion or whatever. So there was this sort of – it was made out of advertising, which was a really cool idea.
Sidney Perkowitz, the subtitle of your book is How a Monster Became an Icon. Take me through that based on what Ed Finn just said and the many varieties of Frankenstein that are out there. How did a monster become such an icon?
Frankenstein became such a leading image in the media that it also became a leading image in culture. So the word Frankenstein has become part of the English language, or even just a prefix Franken, which usually means something definitely not good. For instance, genetically modified food is called Frankenfood. Hurricane Sandy in 2012 that was so destructive in the New York area has become the Frankenstorm and so on. Then there are Frankenstein toys, there are Frankenstein images, Frankenstein cartoons. I've seen a takeoff that merges Albert Einstein's face with Frankenstein's face called Frank Einstein, a terrible pun, but there you are. And a really interesting thing, this goes all the way back to what Professor Lepore talked about. There's always been an image in politics. All the way back to 200 years ago and the struggles with what slavery meant for the British Empire. And right until this year and last year, the Frankenstein image played a big role in the 2016 presidential campaign when both sides accused each other of launching a Frankenstein's monster. So I think calling it an icon or a meme is not understanding the case at all.
Right, because Mary Shelley uses the phrase creature in her book, right? Not necessarily a monster originally. It was only in the 1931 adaptation of the movie starring Boris Karloff that this idea of a monster really takes hold. Isn't that right, Sidney?
Absolutely correct. And Mary's husband, Percy Shelley, always called it the being, a nice neutral word. Mm. It was 1931 and Boris Karloff that made it monstrous.
And so, Ed Finn, has Frankenstein taken on sort of the trappings of a myth here in many ways?
I think it really has. And I think that the fact that almost anybody you ask will know the Frankenstein story, even if they've never read the novel or heard of Mary Shelley or this incredibly rich history that infuses the book, they know the story. And it's arguably as widely known as much older myths like Cinderella. And I think there's something very powerful about that. The fact that in just 200 years it has become so widely known. And I think that speaks to its importance to us as a parable about science and the modern Promethean project of seeking out knowledge and coming to terms with our own increasing powers, the ways in which we are, to quote Stuart Brand, we are as gods and might as well get good at it.
Well, here's another clip from the 1931 film. Dr. Waldman, played by Edward von Sloan, tells Dr. Henry Frankenstein, played by Colin Clive, warns Frankenstein against pursuing his experiment.
Only evil can come of it. Your health will be ruined if you persist in this madness.
I'm astonishingly sane, Doctor.
You have created a monster and it will destroy you.
Patience, patience. I believe in this monster, as you call it.
And from the 1994 movie, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the creature, played by Robert De Niro, confronts Dr. Frankenstein, played by Kenneth Branagh.
Did you ever consider the consequences of your actions? You gave me life, and then you left me to die. Who am I?
You. I don't know.
And you think I'm evil.
So great. Let's go to Jesse in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jesse. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
You bet. Go ahead.
Well, I got my hands on a copy of Frankenstein at a very, very young age. And reading it, a lot of it did go over my head, but I a little bit soaked in about the meaning of life. And I honestly sympathized very, very heavily with Frankenstein's creature, this poor, misunderstood being that was forcibly brought into the world and then subsequently taken out of it by means not of his own. And, you know, looking back, it's in a way sort of the space oddity of science. It's going into the unknown and you're not completely sure what you're going to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesse, it's a great point. Sidney Perkowitz, in 1818, science was pretty crude, right? And now Frankenstein seems even more timely. I read an interview where you said that Mary Shelley's story, especially the ethics of it, this idea of stitching together body parts, applying electricity, and voila, there you have life, resonates even more today because we're so close to making that happen. Unpack that a little bit for me, would you?
Yes, that might have seemed simple in 1818, right. Not long before they discovered that if you apply electricity to a dead body, it'll appear alive momentarily because it'll jerk around. So there was some belief that electricity maybe was the secret to life. We've come a long way since then, but now we're really closer to the secret of life. Instead of stitching together dead body parts, we think we know how to begin to manipulate life at the molecular level. Of course, I'm talking about genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean when I say the story is now more relevant than it was. What was fantasy 200 years ago is getting close to reality by now.
Mm-hmm. Ed Finn, what about that? I mean, you've annotated Frankenstein for scientists and engineers. What do you make of our caller's point?
I think it's a great point, and I agree. I spent a long time rooting for the creature when I first read the novel. And then by the end, of course, you think, well, everybody's made bad choices here. And it's really that question of taking responsibility, scientific creativity and responsibility that my colleagues and I at ASU see as the central message of the novel. What can we learn from Frankenstein for the next 200 years? Not just as a historical project, but as a myth that we can keep working with to get young people, especially who are growing up and moving into these new careers and making all of these choices about the world we're going to live in. How can we take responsibility for our actions? How can we anticipate potential problems and think about creativity and responsibility as deeply linked?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller in Tampa, Florida. Rod is on the line. Hi, Rod. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out couple things. One, that in Shelley's novel, the creature is never called a monster.
Right.
People tend to use the word monster, but he's referred to as a creature, something
mm-hmm.
that was created.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Victor Frankenstein is really the 19th century equivalent of a deadbeat dad who creates something and immediately turns his back on it. And Victor Frankenstein's narrative, Professor Lepore talked about the three frame narratives that we have in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And Victor Frankenstein, once he turns his back on his own creation, he spends the rest of the novel wringing his hands, oh me, oh my. And mm-hmm. when I ask my students which narrative moves them the most, they talk about the creature's narrative, the mm-hmm. one who has had his father turn his back on him.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the narrative of the other.
Mm.
What I love about the novel is that it allows readers to understand the perspective of the other and put themselves in someone else's shoes for a few moments.
Mm. Rod, thank you. What a great call. I appreciate that very much. Let's go to Deborah in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I'd like to say similarly to what Rob had to say, and this is so perfect the day before Valentine's Day. I identify with a monster. I see it as a love story. All this monster is begging for is to have a mate.
Mm.
It's like the unrequited love story of Valentine's Day. And that's the one thing that his maker will not give him. And I just find that heartbreaking. And every time I, you know, feel that I'm not being loved, I just feel like that monster.
Deborah, thank you. We hadn't thought about it that way, Professor Perkowitz, as we booked this hour, a Valentine's Day love story, unrequited love. How do you see it?
Both of these callers are so on track. Their comments show that Mary Shelley's original story had some really deep emotional power. It's about rejecting someone who should be close to you. It's about having the sympathy she develops in the story for the monster who has been rejected and feels it keenly. And even at a bigger level, one of the world's leading science magazines, called Science Magazine, put out by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, just ran an editorial about Frankenstein in the modern age. And the message there was that, like the deadbeat dad who rejected his creation, modern science should really be the opposite. We should not be the deadbeat dad. We should take charge of our creation and make sure it ends up going in a good direction and having a good life.
Mm.
So the messages from the last two callers are just perfect and, to me, just strengthen the power of the novel.
Professor Finn, what's your personal or scholarly takeaway from the novel Frankenstein?
Well, for me, I think you see Victor and the creature as parallels, as mirrors of each other, and they're both deeply lonely. They both, for different reasons, are unable or unwilling to establish ties and companionship with others. When they do try to do that, it doesn't work out well. And that's the fundamental tragedy. It's because Victor closes himself off from society that he makes some of these bad choices in the first place. He's not checking his assumptions or checking his ethical concerns with anybody before he creates the creature. And that's one of the things we need to think about is to resolve the challenges we face. We have to do it together. We have to work together.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We are revisiting the story, The Myth of Frankenstein, this hour. 2018 marks 200 years since the first publication of Mary Shelley's novel. You can join the conversation. Do you have a favorite version of the Frankenstein story? What's your favorite adaptation? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Sidney Perkowitz, Professor Emeritus at Emory University and the co-editor of the 2018 collection Frankenstein, How a Monster Became an Icon, and Ed Finn, who recently co-edited an annotated edition of Mary Shelley's iconic novel. He's one of the directors of the Frankenstein Bicentennial Project at Arizona State University. I want to look at the cultural legacy of Frankenstein now. Here's Bobby Pickett's 1962 novelty song and perennial Halloween radio staple Monster Mash, narrated by a mad scientist whose creation performs a new dance hit routine.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
And since the 1970s, General Mills has produced the monster cereals every Halloween. Here's a commercial for Frankenberry.
Frankenberry cereal is coming your way. How about a monster for breakfast today?
Frankie.
Thanks. And how about some wonderful Frankenberry cereal with oodles and oodles of strawberry-flavored marshmallows?
Ed Finn, what's the cultural legacy of this classic?
It's everywhere.
Yeah, it is.
And it's a story that we feel very comfortable retelling and remixing. We've worn the Halloween costume. You've done the monster mash or the lurch of Victor's creature. And we are very comfortable remixing it, as Sidney pointed out before. Franken is a prefix we can apply to anything, and we all know how that prefix works to make things, you know, strange and perhaps uncomfortable or concerning. So this is a story that we tell. It's a what we call as part of our work at ASU. It's a transmedia narrative. So a little bit like, say, the Star Wars franchise, you can get your Frankenstein in serial form, in toy form, in a novel, in a cartoon. It's told in many different ways by many different people.
So, Sidney Perkowitz, when we look at Frankenstein through the eyes of a Halloween costume or a cartoon or a breakfast cereal, is something lost? I mean, I hate to be too serious here, but is something lost in the original text of what Mary Shelley intended?
Yes, something is lost, but I'm not sure it's a loss that we should regret. The original story is a serious story. There is serious stuff going on in it. A new kind of creature has been made, very unhappy at the status of his life and his creation and so on. And yet the story has so many tentacles, so many angles, that it can also be transmuted almost into a fairy tale. And even into two of the greatest comic films of all time, at least among American films, Young Frankenstein and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, both of which are on lists of the 100 funniest American movies of all times. So to me, it's just one more way of saying that somehow this 18-year-old young woman, and that is the age that Mary Shelley was when she first started writing the story, the age of a college freshman to really bring this home, managed to produce something that has not only lived 200 years but can be interpreted in so many different ways. Mm. The cultural impact goes in all directions, toward the direction of horror, toward the direction of we'd better watch out what science is doing, and also toward the direction of a little plush stuffed toy creature that a young child can clutch and that yet has two electrodes in its neck because it's an image of Frankenstein.
Let's go to Kyle in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Kyle. I'm glad you called and thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm as an avid science fiction fan, really thankful to Shelley for striking on what I think is the core question of science fiction, which is what is mankind's responsibilities as our power grows technologically and knowledge-wise. And you see it echoed out in a lot of modern science fiction, particularly Blade Runner recently is a good example. You see touches of it in other things like Ex Machina and stuff like that. This question of what responsibilities do we have when our creations become more and more lifelike?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Ex Machina, it touched on the responsibility to hand down some kind of morality. They basically created life and cut it loose, which is very similar to Frankenstein's plight.
Mm.
And I'm just really kind of thrilled to see that theme recurring in our science fiction today.
Kyle, thank you. It's a great point. Ed Finn, what about the morality tale in Frankenstein?
Well, I think what's interesting about the original novel and that we still need today is how messy it is. It's not a clear-cut black and white story. It's not a traditional fairy tale, though I agree with Sydney that often it is retold as that. But Victor's choices, they're not always so simple. The creature's choices are not so simple. Everybody comes out making some bad decisions in the novel. And we need to have that story now because our decisions are not so clear-cut either. Sometimes we're talking about creating new life or resurrecting an extinct species. Other times we're talking about making modifications, whether we're going to use gene drives to try and cure malaria, for example, where the ethics are really complicated. And we need Frankenstein story to work through. I like to think of science fiction as a really inexpensive laboratory for thinking about possible futures. We need to tell these stories to work through the world that we want to live in and avoid some of the mistakes that we might stumble into otherwise.
Mm. Sydney Perkowitz, to caller Kyle's point, what should we be applying today in terms of science and medicine and ethics from what we've learned from Frankenstein?
Frankenstein has a message that everyone will agree to, I think, that there ought to be a way to make sure that what science and technology do is for the good of humanity and not for the ill of humanity. The hard part is how to execute that. My own feeling is that, for instance, having Frankenstein become as much of a cultural icon as it is helps us think about it. And that includes the idea of what it means for science fiction that Kyle brought up. When you see a very contemporary film like the original Blade Runner or the newest one, you're again seeing the Frankenstein story.
Mm.
And you're again seeing some of the issues that creating a kind of synthetic life would create. And then that means that people begin to think a little bit about what this would mean in reality.
Mm.
We're not there yet where the ethics develops along at the same speed that the science does. But I think we're getting closer. When the atomic bomb was made, some nuclear scientists got together and decided they need to make sure people understood there were ethical issues. And that's now happening with genetic engineering. We're seeing lots of reports about what the future of genetic engineering may hold, and how fast or how slowly we should go in driving toward the goal of making that a real scientific achievement. So we're changing a little bit, not very fast, but I think in the right direction.
Kyle, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to David in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
In listening to these stories about Frankenstein, I was reminded that sometime in the mid-70s, I would say, when I was ordering books through the school, you know, paperbacks and whatnot.
Yeah.
A movie had come out that was on TV. It was either a TV movie or perhaps even a short miniseries about Frankenstein. It was called Frankenstein, The True Story.
Hmm.
It was a really nice adaptation, of the story, and I believe in that story there was also a bride of Frankenstein created, and it ended up with Frankenstein alone on a ship frozen in the ice in the Arctic, I believe. Mm. But I just wonder if your guests have heard of that production.
David, thank you. Ed Finn?
I am not familiar with that one, no. Yeah. But there are a lot out there.
500 adaptations, I think I read. Is that about, sound about right, Ed Finn?
Depending on how you count and what, you know, sometimes people are just borrowing a character. Sometimes they're actually putting Frankenstein in the title. But that sounds probably a good ballpark number.
David, thank you. Here's Kelly in Somerville, South Carolina. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Hi. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so excited that you're talking about Frankenstein. It's my favorite book. I have him tattooed on my arm along with five other favorite books. And
good for you.
My favorite thing about Frankenstein is that if you know, how do you feel when you know someone is watching you all the time? I always tell people that Frankenstein was like the first stalker, because imagine you know this creature is watching you all the time, but you don't know where he is. So poor Dr. Frankenstein just has this horrible anxiety and fear and getting ulcers because he knows this thing is watching him. And for the creature to say to him, I will be with you on your wedding night. Now, imagine you're getting married in a couple of months, and you know this creature is going to be there sometime that night because he's going to kill your fiance. Because if you're not going to build me a mate, then I'm going to destroy your mate, which is exactly what he did. He strangles Elizabeth on their wedding night.
Kelly, thank you. Hadn't thought about it that way, the original stalker. Appreciate your call and the image of that tattoo on your arm. Appreciate it. Valerie in Nashville, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question that's kind of related.
Okay.
I was thinking, in terms of the parallels between Victor and his creature, you know, Victor also kind of loses his father, except he rejects his father, and he basically trades his father for a stack of books that, you know, he doesn't like his father criticizing that he's reading these old books, and he basically decides, well, I'd rather have the books than my father, and keeps on with those books. It leads him directly to this creation. And I've always found that the most curious, inexplicable moment in the novel for me is the moment that Victor rejects the creature, which is exactly the moment that it comes to life. And so this watery eye opens up, and Victor just freaks out. And I would just, I've never really seen any kind of in-depth explanation of what's going on there. But if anybody has an explanation of exactly why, what causes Victor to reject that creature, does it relate in some way to his rejection of his own father? That's my interest.
Valerie, thank you. Sidney Perkowitz, what do you think? Do you have an answer for Valerie?
It is really a crucial moment, and Valerie is so right to pick that as maybe the moment in the whole story. No, it's never explained. The family dynamics, which is such a big part of the novel, certainly could be considered part of the explanation. My own feeling is that Frankenstein never quite thought he would make this work. And we saw when he saw it in the original Mary Shelley's story that he had actually made a creature and saw it move. The whole weight of guilt, the thought of, am I now playing God, the thought of what have I done, suddenly descended on him. And the creature he had made was not as beautiful as he had envisioned. So all of that came together and he had this moment of rejection, which entirely colored and ruined the creature's life and the whole rest of the story.
Valerie, thanks so much for that call. I was wondering, Ed Finn, about the copyright of Frankenstein. Obviously, it's long lapsed into the public domain, but who benefits now from some of her original work?
It's a great question. And of course, anybody is free to make their own adaptation of the text of Frankenstein because it is long out of copyright. But if you try and create a visual representation of the creature, you may get a call from Universal Pictures lawyers. They copyrighted the creature, the Frankenstein monster that they created for the 1931 film. And they have a legal description of it. I don't remember all of the points, but I think there's something like six different facets that include a high forehead and a scar and neck bolts. And if you have all of them, then you may have to wrangle with them about that, which of course hasn't stopped people from all sorts of different adaptations and versions of Frankenstein visually in every medium you can imagine. But there are some attempts to try and capture or define a legal representation of Frankenstein, which you could argue is yet another Frankenstein's monster.
Mm. Ed, tell me a little bit about the Frankenstein Bicentennial Project, what kind of work you're doing through this year, what you're trying to achieve over the next 200 years in honor of this iconic work.
Well, we're really focused on reaching young people and getting them to think about Frankenstein. And I'll mention two things. One is we've created our own modern-day Frankenstein story, so especially targeted at teens, but it's open to people, kids younger who want to play with their parents and older people who probably will still enjoy the story quite a lot. And that's at frankenstein200.org, where you can sign up to be an intern in Victoria Frankenstein's laboratory. She's a fifth-generation descendant of the original Dr. Frankenstein, it's quite a lot of fun, and it again encourages the player to take responsibility and make your own ethical choices as you play through the story and confront a Frankenstein tale. And the second thing is we've taken the annotated edition that we've talked about that came out last year, and we've put it online. It's completely free and open access, and we call it Frankenbook. Frankenbook.org, and we really want to encourage people, especially students, but people in book clubs or other groups, to come and annotate that novel. So we have all of the annotations from our print edition. We've added a bunch of new ones. We're going to be putting up some videos and other commentaries from scientists next month. Mm. It's continuing to evolve, but it's a sort of live beta. It's an experiment, and we want people to come and play in the text and make it their own.
Oh, that's great. I've got about 30 seconds left, Professor Perkowitz, I'll give you the last word. Mary Shelley created Frankenstein as a ghost story in 1818. What do you think the creature in her story would be today?
Today, the creature would be the equivalent of a Blade Runner, a very sleek, modern version of what was once a shambling creature, almost indistinguishable from humanity, but still with the same questions swirling around it. Questions so broad that it took us 17 people in the collection of essays we just published to cover every possible angle of Frankenstein. Mm. I think every reader can find something out of the story to suit his own life or his own set of beliefs.
It is timeless indeed. What a great panel. Thank you so much to both of you. Sidney Perkowitz, co-editor of Frankenstein, How a Monster Became an Icon. I appreciate your time, Professor. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Ed Finn, co-director of the Frankenstein Bicentennial Project at ASU, Arizona State. Glad to have you with us, Ed Finn. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
And listeners, thanks to you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.